ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, Joseph Strider is an urban Indian who happens to be a musician. Deborah Boris talks about her Street Stories suspense series, and we feature beloved American novelist Jim Harrison's collection of novellas, Brown Dog, in our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know. Don't mind what happens now and then, as long as you'll be.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
Hi, I'm Johnny Gomez.
On today's show, we are very pleased to have on from Los Angeles, California, Johnny Gomez, who is a screenwriter, and he's currently working on Third Wheel. It's his latest project, and welcome, Johnny, and thank you so much for being part of our show today.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here with you guys.
Well, let's have some fun, Johnny.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot of fun. Even we, as you know, we're missing Maya and Chrissy today, and so we invited Johnny to come and join us, and I think we're going to have a good time today, guys.
I'm going to try to get in touch with my feminine side, if that helps.
That would be very helpful. Well, as you guys all know, I am a huge pop culture geek, love comic books, huge superhero nerd, and I was really thrilled to hear this. DC Comics, they just had success with the Batman trilogy and Man of Steel, and they, of course, have announced that there's a new movie coming, Batman versus Superman is the working title, and we talked about it before, I think. They've cast Ben Affleck as Batman, and Henry Cavill will, of course, reprise his role as Superman. And they just actually recently announced, very, very recently, that they have cast someone to be Wonder Woman.
Wow.
I'm pretty surprised.
Is it Maya Seligman?
It's not Maya. I mean, I heard she was in the running, but she just didn't get the part. The part did go, though, to Gail Gadot. You may know her from the Fast and the Furious franchise. I think she's been in a couple of those. She will be Wonder Woman. Now, the fact that the announcement came kind of late, they're talking about starting in February of 2014, there's a good chance it's going to be maybe just a cameo role. You know, DC had been talking about wanting to try to duplicate the success Marvel had with the Avengers. I don't know how successful it's going to be. You know, Marvel put years of effort into, a Captain America movie, a Hulk movie, a Thor movie, kind of bringing them all together.
I don't think it really matters, Jerry, because, Batman versus Superman is like, a company's dream come true. Every kid in the world and every adult who used to be a kid, which is most of them, you're going to see McDonald's cups. You're going to see all kinds of stuff. And, every kid is going to have his own preference, It largely depends on if you have a Superman t-shirt or you have a Batman t-shirt. And I'm really surprised that Ben Affleck, got the role as Batman. But he is a good actor. So we'll see how he does with that, because he is one of those actors that you would think, he's not right for that role. But he's such a good actor that he could probably pull it off. And I'll give you a quick example of that. And that's Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Now, in one of his first big movies, he was already a big star, but Interview with a Vampire.
Right.
Okay, now Interview with a Vampire, he was cast in the lead role.
Yep.
And Anne Rice, who also wrote the screenplay, Johnny, you can identify with that. When she was told that Tom Cruise was cast as the lead, she was very vocal about she didn't want him to be the lead. She didn't think he was right for it, and it was going to, take away from her book. And they told Cruise about it, who was a big star at the time. You know, he had just done, you know, Top Gun and all these things.
Yeah, Risky Business, Days of Thunder, right. All of those.
And her concern was that, you know, he was too much of a pretty boy, right, yeah. Exactly. And so Cruise said to her, look, why don't you just wait until you see the movie, and then you can tell me what you think. And then she said, she goes, very rarely do I have to publicly apologize.
She
goes,
but she did.
Yeah, she did publicly apologize.
I remember that.
She said he was perfect, and she didn't think that he had it in his tool bag to do that. And I think you might find the same thing with Ben Affleck.
See, I think the same thing, too. You know, I think it's one of those things, you know, for this particular, I think part of the problem is there was just a Batman franchise. And Christian Bale was very, very good at it. But, you know, the same thing was said when Michael Keaton was cast as Batman. There was no internet. But if there was, it would have been ablaze with, oh, my God, that's the worst idea ever. When Heath Ledger was cast as the Joker, I'd never seen Heath Ledger in anything. But I knew he was in, like, First Night and he was a pretty boy. And my initial thought was, what are they smoking? That's ridiculous. And yet he turned in probably one of the best performances, not just in a comic book movie, but like ever. I mean, I was so amazed.
Yeah, he did his portrayal of the Joker was, you know, phenomenal, and it was one of the best things he did in his short life. But I mean, let's look at it back in his perspective, and that's the, I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, been in action movies, you know, Heath Ledger, and then, you know, his most recent very popular movie that he did was Brokeback Mountain. So he goes from playing a gay cowboy to, I'm the Joker. So people are like, you know, they were skeptical about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's going to be the same. It's the same thing with Affleck. You know, you have the two camps. They either absolutely love the idea or they absolutely hate the idea. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of middle ground. Kevin Smith, you know, who did a lot of movies with Affleck. They've been friends for a long time. He lives in the house Affleck sold him. And he had always said long before this that, you know, he thought Affleck was a good enough actor that he could portray Jaws in a remake of Jaws. You know, he had the utmost confidence.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if I'd go that far to say that he was that good. I mean, he was damn good in, you know, Jay and Silent Bob. But,
but you know, and that's the thing, you know, is Affleck has shown that he has range. I'm not withholding judgment. I'm actually on, I'd say,
what do you think about
Affleck.
This, Johnny? You're the screenwriter.
Well,
what do you think?
Yeah. You know, the thing of it is, too, film is such a collaborative medium. It's the kind of thing where just one person's vision is always really hard to bring to screen by themselves. The more people that get input, the more people that get involved with these things, typically the better the art at the end of it is. You know, that's the old phrase, art through adversity. You kind of need a lot of different voices coming into it. So I'm excited. I mean, they rebooted the Spider-Man franchise after it had been dead for, what, a year?
Yeah.
I mean, it was still warm, and they threw a new person in there as Spider-Man, and it was a really good movie.
Yeah.
And you can make the argument that it was a better movie. We've already had, what, four Hulks, I think, in the last 15 years? They keep redoing that. I mean, you have to remember, too, a lot of this material is so old, where Marvel was working trying to introduce people to Thor, reintroduce people to Captain America. Batman and Superman are, like you were saying earlier, it's Coke and Pepsi. You don't need to tell people who these characters are.
Yeah. My biggest hope for it is that they don't feel the need to retell Batman's origin story. If you live in America and you don't know Batman's origin story, you don't belong at that movie, because they've done it so many. Every time it seems like they feel the need to redo it. I get it with the Superman, but, you know, that's an interesting point, too, because there was a study about the use of, like, the sum versus the parts. You know, just because you put 10 A-list actors in a movie does not mean it's going to be successful. It's the inner working of the pieces that make the movie a success. So even if Wonder Woman is just a cameo, that little cog, I think, is what could really have an effect. Another, you know, cog in this machine is Amy Adams, you know, who played, I think, Lois Lane in the new Superman movie, and she'll be returning.
She's an incredible actress.
She is. But then there's another time. There's been multiple Lois Lanes, you know, so it certainly can be done that rebooting can really, really revitalize a franchise.
That's true, yeah.
So Amy Adams is another integral part of that story. She was the female lead in the Superman with Henry Cavill, and she was asked about what about a possible love triangle between, you know, Lois and Superman and Wonder Woman, and she basically said, I don't know, you know, we'll see. But her big thing was she hopes that she can be involved on screen with another woman where it's not a love triangle. So it would be fun, but it would be nice if they teamed up maybe together rather than constantly compete for Superman's affection.
Those love triangles that they try to work in movies to try to make
money.
They're tough. You know, I remember when we had the love triangle with me and Amy and Wonder Woman did. It was, you know, it was a little detrimental. Ben Affleck wouldn't speak to me for weeks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought there was a love triangle between you, Amy, and Miss Piggy on the set of The Muppets. Wasn't that what it was?
Well, that was another year, but that's a whole different, that's a whole different story.
Digging deep.
Ooh, you smashed for that one, Rambo.
You know, I like the original Batman. I like Keaton. I like Jack Nicholson, you know, but this is great how... You know, the whole movie industry is almost reinvigorated as a comic book, you know, where we get all these different films, we can throw in different actors, and, you know, Batman, Wonder Woman, they're not the only one. The next one is Terminator. You know, we all remember the Terminator movies from, you know, that James Cameron did in the 80s. Well, Paramount and director... I'll be back. They are back. Paramount and director Alan Taylor are looking closely at Emilia Clarke and Brie Larson to play the role of Sarah Connor in the Terminator reboot that is being assembled for a July 2015 release. Both actresses have tested for the producers, and they are the front runners to play one of the screen's most formidable heroines, as originated by Linda Hamilton in the first two films. Sure, we all remember her. She was great in this movie. She really, you know, brought a lot of suspense, and, you know, people cared for her character as Arnold Schwarzenegger is hunting her down. They're going to cast a Sarah Connor role before Reese and John Connor, and guess what?
What's that?
Arnold Schwarzenegger is coming back again.
No.
Yes.
Oh, he's like,
as the Terminator.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll be back.
He told everyone.
He said he'd be back.
Talk about paying fan service to everyone, too. I mean, if they cast Emilia Clarke in this, the fanboys are going to go nuts. I mean, if she goes straight from Game of Thrones to a Terminator reboot, I mean, that's going to be incredible.
Yeah. I
hope it happens. You know what? I love her in Game of Thrones because she has such a great acting ability.
Yeah. Yes. But you love her acting ability, air quotes.
Yes, I do love her acting ability. And, you know,
she's worked with the director before, too. So there's a lot of chemistry there.
Right, and she is a very good actress, and you know, one of the things about her is it's really kind of, it's just fascinating to me. Maybe it's just a guy thing. I don't know, guys. You tell me. You know, one, she's a beautiful woman, but, you know, in Game of Thrones, she's a blonde. But in real life, she's brunette.
Well, and Sarah Connor is brunette, correct? Mm. Whereas Brie Larson is naturally blonde and would have to dye her hair. So, I mean, that's just...
That's the stuff that Hollywood's made of, man.
I'm telling you, that is really just pure acting right there. Just the
I also
I think, you know, Arnold's going to be totally confused. I come back from California to be in the movie.
California.
I don't know.
Yeah. Next they'll have Batman versus Terminator. You
know? Well, they did do Batman versus Alien versus Predator in the comic books. That was kind of funny. People love crossovers. They love reboots and they love crossovers. Look at the success of the Star Trek reboot. I mean, that thing has done very, very well. So I think a Terminator reboot could absolutely do well.
I'll tell you what. You know what? All these comic book movies and all this stuff that's coming out, you know, superheroes and stuff like that. Well, we have a real-life superhero that probably will be making a movie, I would imagine, sometime in 2014. And he hasn't said anything, but I just kind of feel that way because Jay-Z seems to be all over the place. He's a sports agent. He's a rap mogul.
A restaurateur.
He's a restaurateur. He's married to one of the most beautiful women in the world. You know, he's just...
He is as close to Superman, everywhere, I think, as we are going to get. You know, and he brought some new material to the kickoff for the Magna Carta tour, and it was amazing. He was in St. Paul. The crowd went nuts. He was just, I mean, he was everywhere. He was mixed in some of his new stuff, stuck with some of his hits, you know, off of Empire State of Mind. It rocked. It was simply amazing. I don't know.
Jay-Z's never been someone to shy away from collaboration either. I mean, there's this great YouTube clip you can find of Jay-Z walking on stage at a Phish concert. Of all places.
Oh, no way.
Oh, my God.
Guys from Phish are playing background for 99 Problems and for another one of his songs. I forget which one. But the crowd goes nuts. They go absolutely berserk. And it's amazing because, I mean, Jay looks at the audience at one point, looks back at the guys in Phish, and he's like, dang, where y'all been hiding these people? I mean, he is never afraid to get new fans by going out and putting himself out.
You know, Jay, now that you bring it up, it reminds me because, like, when he played in England – at a huge festival in England, Jay-Z, he was the headliner at the O2 or whatever when they opened it up.
Yeah, at O2 Arena.
Right, and he opened up with an Oasis song.
Oh my god! Really? Wow!
Yeah, he opened up with the Champagne Supernova, and he brought out Liam Gallagher to sing the song with him.
Oh, that is amazing!
And then, like, two polar opposites.
That's what's crazy. You know, that's like Johnny Cash and you know, Megadeth teaming up to do a song. You know what I mean? It's like, well, you know,
but
yet it worked.
But that's not too far out of the realm of possibility. I mean, you know, Johnny Cash, you know, before he passed away, one of his biggest songs was from Trent Reznor.
Inch Nails. He did Rusty Cage from Soundgarden. He did some Depeche Mode. He really nailed. They're called the American albums. I have them. They're absolutely great. You know, it's that it really does work.
Well, we were just talking about this so much. Is that what you were gonna say? For the movies. I mean, it's like the same thing in the music industry. It's like these reboots.
It's kind of like this when celebrities launch their own bands. For every one that's good, there's 100 that aren't. I'm looking at you, Bruce Willis. I'm looking at you, Russell Crowe. You know, it's like every once in a while you get one that's good, but it's like you're already a movie star. You're already making millions. You're already recognizable.
Well, you know,
it's
another thing too with, like, you know, movies, right? Your band's doing movies. You know,
yeah.
The Beatles had a huge success with Hard Day's Night.
Yep.
You know, and they were the first ones, and it was, you know, nothing that, you know, I mean, Elvis had done 10 million movies before, but, you know, nobody wanted to see Elvis. Not even Elvis wanted to see Elvis movies.
Yep.
You know? But, you know, they had a huge success with it, and everyone's tried to emulate it ever since. Madonna, you know, she's tried to be a movie actress so many times, and, you know, but she did do one movie that she never gets the credit for, that she was fantastic, and that was Evita. She was...
Oh, my God, she
that
was
so
good
in that. One of the best movies of all time.
I loved that, and I'm a fan of the musical, and I was... When I heard... That's one of those Affleck-type situations where it's like, I heard, oh, okay, they're doing Evita. Madonna, are you kidding me? But she crushed it, man.
Oh, she was like born to be Ava
Perón.
Ava
Perón, absolutely.
I've never seen it. I've only seen the play. I've actually never seen Madonna's version.
No, I highly recommend that you stream it, man.
I love the song she sings. That, you know, the
Don't
the
Cry For Me, Argentina. It's she did a beautiful rendition. Yeah, kind of like with how Les Miserables went this year. I was pretty impressed with the singing in Les Mis. That was another.
You know what?
Even Russell Crowe.
Except, you know, Russell Crowe. And listen, let me tell you something. Les Miserables is a great book, and it was one of the movies that I have ever seen in my life. I tell you what, musical did not work for me.
I thought the music was good. As a musical, it did not. It just didn't work. Like,
that's the thing. Adapting a musical, especially something made for the stage to the screen, is incredibly difficult. Yep. Rent is one of the most profitable, you know, Broadway shows that's ever gone on. It was up there with Cats and A Chorus Line. And when they made that into a movie, I mean, it was terrible. I mean, when you're taking a musical and you're putting it onto the screen, what you lose is the audience interaction. You lose this, you know, close, someone sitting 10 feet away from you, and you can read the emotion on their face, and you're playing it differently. And so when you move that onto the screen, onto the silver screen, as they say, you kind of lose that personal aspect. And if you don't make up for that with different storytelling tools that you have in a movie versus a play, you lose all of that, what makes it special. And I mean, you just named two of those that just didn't translate.
Yeah, it makes it two-dimensional.
There are some that do make the great. Okay, Evita would be one. That was a musical, and it was even a better movie. Oklahoma.
I would say West Side Story.
You know what? West Side Story. It's one of my personal all-time favorites. And I think it was a better movie than it was
a play. Yeah. But, you know, you look at it. If you were to, like, I'll bet if we got a list of, like, the top 20 highest-grossing Broadway plays of all time and the ones that got made into movies, I'd bet 7 out of 10 were failures. Like, Phantom of the Opera. They've tried to do that. One of the best-selling Broadway plays ever. And it cannot get a big-screen version that doesn't suck. Period. Cats, you know, that's another huge one that doesn't. I'll be interested to see if they try to make the Book of Mormon into a movie, because I'd watch that.
If anyone's going to do it, it's going to be Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
You know it will. You know they'll retain those rights.
You know, Madonna was so great in Evita, and, you know, but music is her forte, and she has been nominated and received several Grammys, and well deserved. And the thing that always fascinates me is that when a sex symbol, which is Madonna, that's what she is,
yep.
And she just has one of the most beautiful voices around, and she actually writes her own music, you know. And so that's what the Grammys are all about, is all these different talented artists, and I'm looking forward to see what's going on this year with them.
Well, every year, the Grammy voters manage to stun with their surprise nominees and snubs. And the 56th Annual Grammy Awards are no exception. from Nirvana getting a nod in the best rap song category to recognition for Bob Marley and Led Zeppelin, these are our biggest surprises from Grammy Night nomination. As mentioned in our Grammy wrap-up, Kurt Cobain is sort of nominated in the Best Rap Song category because nominee Jay-Z's Holy Grail borrows some lyrics from Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. That doesn't mean Nirvana would get a Best Rap Song Grammy if Jay-Z's track wins, but it's still a strange sight.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Led Zeppelin, nominated twice for Best Rock Performance, Kashmir, and Best Rock Album, Celebration Day, even though the legendary act technically disbanded in 1980 and haven't performed together since their one-off concert in December 2007.
Unreal.
Yeah, how did that happen, right?
I feel like a crazy – I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. What year is it? Nirvana and Led Zeppelin are both mentioned at the Grammys.
Have you noticed that the Grammy Academies, which we are members of –
Yeah, you went last year, didn't you?
I have been before. I didn't go last year.
Oh, okay.
But the one of the things about the Grammys, and it's all big institutions that give awards, like the Oscars and you know, the Golden Globes and things like that. It seems to me like when a big act like Zeppelin, you know, who's never recognized, and they look around at these guys who just received the Kennedy Award Center honors, and they look at them and they say, like, wow, Led Zeppelin, man, look at these guys. They're like 65, 70 years old. They're all, they ain't going to be around too much longer. Well, you know, maybe we got to give them that Grammy now.
Yeah. kind of like the Academy's apology to Martin Scorsese. Like, hey, sorry Goodfellas lost out to Shakespeare in Love. Here's an award for The Departed.
Yeah, well,
you know, my favorite joke about the Scorsese, too, was Jon Stewart 2 days later. Oh, no, he was hosting that one. Yes, right. Jon Stewart was hosting that Oscars, walked out on stage after 310 Mafia won an Academy Award and told the audience, for those of you keeping score at home, that's 310 Mafia 1, Martin Scorsese 0.
Well, you know, I'm looking at the list of the Grammy things. Here's a few of the others that are nominated. Paul McCartney is nominated. The Rolling Stones are nominated. It makes me wonder, what year is this?
Yeah, that's what I love about this Grammy list. I mean, it's like, you know, they took all your favorite musicians you've ever liked and they put them into this celebrity death match with each other years after their height and popularity. You know, it's like being able to watch the Packers, you know, from the 60s.
The 66 Packers.
Right, you know, play the 49ers.
Yeah. Star.
Cowboys.
Yeah, something. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just unbelievable.
I'm excited for the Grammys. I'm always excited for the Grammys. That's one of those award shows that's just imminently watchable. They're so entertaining. They really get what they are. They're a show about musicians, and they have no qualms just getting the people who are nominated up there, performing, and putting on a good show. One of the award shows that's had a little bit of trouble making their show watchable has been the Golden Globes. And I think the best thing about their announcement that they made on Thursday is that coming back to host will be Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, who were fantastic last year when they hosted. So in all of their announcements for awards and all of the nominations, that's what I'm most excited about because it means I want to watch this show. I'm not just going to, you know, pull up the internet the next day and see who won. There's a lot of your, you know, expected nominations. Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture. A lot of the same old names that you've seen. Cate Blanchett for Blue Jasmine. Sandra Bullock for Gravity. Dame Judi Dench for Philomena. Emma Thompson for Saving Mr. Banks. And Kate Winslet for Labor Day. You know, definitely some of the blue bloods in there with the actresses. It's different.
I hope that, you know, that Blue Jasmine wins.
Blue Jasmine?
Yeah. She was
Blue
fantastic.
Jasmine was a great movie.
Did you see it?
I did.
I saw it as well, and I thought it was like, let me ask you this, Johnny. I was a little thrown by the ending. I thought I had the ending all figured out. And I, you know.
Isn't that good, though?
I don't know. No, I know what he's saying. The thing about Blue Jasmine, it's not an ending where it's like a twist or there's some sort of a, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe that happened. It's almost as if Woody Allen ran out of film and was like, it's a wrap. We're done. Don't worry about it.
Well, let me give people out there, for all of our listening audience out there, I'm going to tell you something. There is a part in the movie where you think you have it all figured out. And now we're not going to give you a spoiler alert because I'm not going to tell you, but Johnny, you'll know. And it's where the one scene where she blows up and then she kind of, you know, relives it with Alec Baldwin. And then you're like, oh, damn, I didn't see that coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
That's
I do.
Good.
No, I totally know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I look forward to that. You know, as a as a writer myself, as a man who absorbs pop culture like it's going out of style, I'm happily surprised when there's a twist of some kind or something unexpected. You know, most movies follow a pretty formulaic plan, so anytime there's a deviation from there within certain parameters, I'm happy for it. When I get caught off guard, I love it.
It's a great movie. It's hysterical at times, but it's not. You know, it's just the way Woody Allen writes, and it's not so overwhelming where you're going to get you know, huge emotional feelings like, wow, that was really messed up. Or it's just not that type of movie. You'll enjoy it from the beginning to the end. But I'm so glad that they got a nomination at the Golden Globes. What else is going on at the Golden Globes there, Johnny?
The other things that are worth noting is the Golden Globes are one of those award shows that split Best Picture into two different categories. They have five nominations for Best Motion Picture in a drama, and then five nominations for Best Motion Picture in a comedy or musical, which is an interesting way to split it. Yeah, and studios have the ability to submit their film in either category. They get to choose which one they do. Now, the Academy behind the Golden Globes, they're the ones who get to make the ultimate decision, but it's definitely very important for how these films submit. And some of these producers we're talking about earlier in the week, they were sweating over making their decision. Films like American Hustle, Her, Inside Llewyn Davis, The Wolf of Wall Street, these are all films that were kind of in between. They weren't necessarily a straight drama. They weren't necessarily a straight comedy. And a lot of those ended up submitting into the comedy category. So
thinking they'd movies, have better chances, maybe?
Thinking... And they all ended up against each other. You've got American Hustle, Her, Inside Llewyn Davis, Nebraska, and The Wolf of Wall Street all competing for Best Comedy. And those all sound like knee slappers, don't they?
That is
The Wolf of Wall Street, that's hilarious.
That is bizarre because I wouldn't categorize any of those as a comedy. Like The Wolf of Wall Street is a drama with comedic elements, especially, God bless Jonah Hill, I love that guy. The scene with him and the girl and all the money taped up.
Let me tell you this, though. Here's the thing. It's like, these movies have either just come out or they haven't even been released yet.
True.
So, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Because we can talk about Wolf of Wall Street, but nobody here has seen it.
Yeah, exactly. No. I've seen like three trailers.
We've seen some trailers. Yeah. So, you know, you've seen a funny trailer with Jonah Hill.
Yeah, that's true. There could be a lot more that they're not showing us.
It could be way funnier. It could be very funny.
Yeah, thank you. Exactly.
So, Johnny, do you get to walk the red carpet at all? Are you down there when you're?
You know, I don't. I actually worked the Emmys a couple of months ago. I got to work the red carpet with part of the crew that puts on the Emmys, and that was really fun. Getting to watch all the television stars come in.
Did you see Emilia Clarke?
I did. Oh, my goodness. I saw Emilia Clarke. I made a mental image in my head that I'll never forget.
A mental image that you'll never forget.
No, but I was more excited not to see Emilia Clarke, but to be able to see Bryan Cranston. I'm a Breaking Bad fan. They are, of course, nominated for Best Television Series, going up against Downton Abbey, The Good Wife, House of Cards, and Master of Sex, which is something that is also interesting. House of Cards, a Netflix exclusive, an internet television show, has been nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Television Series.
I haven't seen it, but I know it's a big success for them.
Just yesterday, I had a friend of mine spend 10 minutes telling me how awesome House of Cards is.
Was that Ben Affleck?
No, it was not Ben Affleck. No, Ben's been really busy lately. You know, that bat suit's really hard to get in and out of. Okay. So I don't think he can, like, you know how you got to swipe on the phone? I think the gloves are keeping him.
So yeah, you and Chrissy McIntyre.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so when Chrissy McIntyre sees the bat signal up there, she's like, it's on.
Well, look, I just think...
She lives in Gotham City.
Yeah,
so.
There you go.
I think Ben Affleck is just a very interesting person. Now, he's not fascinating, because if he were, he would probably have been on Barbara Walters' 2013 list of most fascinating people.
Baba Wawa.
Baba Wawa. Hello, I'm Baba Wawa. So, and I'm going to throw it out to you guys. Anybody got a top of their head guess, somebody who's on the 2013 most fascinating list of Barbara Walters?
I'm going to go with Prince George, the newborn.
The world's most famous infant. Yes, indeed. A couple of the others, you'll recognize some. We've got some celebrities here. Jennifer Lawrence, the Hollywood darling, as they are calling her. You know, she won an Oscar last year.
She's extremely likable.
She is
a darling. She's beautiful. She's a great actress. And she's like, what, like 22, 23 years old?
I think 22. And the thing I love most about her is unlike some people, I'm looking at you, Justin Bieber, she doesn't read her own press, and so to speak. You know, I mean, she seems normal. She laughs. She'll fart. You know, she'll have, you know, she'll just do whatever. She tripped, I think, at the Oscars last year.
She did.
She just laughed it off. And yeah,
when she won the Academy Award, she tripped walking up the stairs.
Yeah, exactly. So another one on the list was, unfortunately, Miley Cyrus.
Wait a minute. Say what you will about Miley Cyrus.
All right. Well, you know my feelings on this. We've discussed this before.
Well, you know what? Say what you will about Miss Cyrus, but I think that you're going to see longevity with her.
Yeah.
You're going to see longevity with her, as you've done, you know, seen with Britney Spears and a few others. Yep. But I think you'll see her grow more because she does have a really good voice, and she is a writer. So.
Very talented. Another on the list, the celebrity, is Kimye. Kim Kardashian and Kanye West.
Oh, I didn't even know that's what they called them.
Yeah, Kimye, exactly. And they from a baby who's named after a compass, getting engaged in a baseball stadium in front of TV cameras, and of course one of the most fascinating videos I've ever seen of them on a motorcycle that was so good that Seth Rogen and James Franco reduplicated it shot for shot with the two of them.
And
in the
you know what? I saw that with James Franco and Seth Rogen.
So funny.
That video was so good. And it was like, you know, and one of the things, you know, our audience may or may not have noticed, because, you know, Kanye West, who gets a lot of press lately and, you know, a genius because he says
he
is.
A genius.
And, but I do like his music. But the thing about it is like, you know, he always takes offense to everybody who does parodies on him when Jimmy Kimmel did that thing. But you notice there was no backlash from James Franco, Seth Rogen. So that just tells me that he is in with all the rest of us that saw it and said, oh my gosh, this is hysterical.
It's
this
great.
Is great.
Yeah, exactly.
And, well, and then, did you hear his comment recently that Kanye said that if Kim Kardashian were a music star, she would be bigger than Beyonce?
Oh my God, that guy is so delusional.
That's the thing.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, you know, there's so much about Kanye West and Beyonce and Miley Cyrus and all these people that are talented but are really off the deep end. It's so refreshing that there's actually some very talented people who just are not crazy.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about, Si?
I don't know, Helter Skelter, you know, would be about as crazy as the Beatles get. But every Thanksgiving weekend in Portland, Maine, more than two dozen of New England's top artists gather for Beatles Night, an arena-sized set leaning heavily on late-period songs the Beatles never attempted in concert. That's interesting. I never realized that, like, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and, like, those albums, you know, after that, were never performed live in concert.
Really?
Yeah. So they never, you know, they never learned to play them together.
Well, no, it's not that. They stopped touring, and those albums were released, Sgt. Pepper's, Abbey Road, you know, and all those songs, they didn't play as a band together. They never toured. They played them as a band, obviously, because they recorded them, but they never had done them live, and which is interesting because Oasis, Liam Gallagher was saying, you know, like, people always, you know, liken Oasis to a Beatles knockoff, right? And they would do I Am the Walrus in concert as their encore.
Huh.
And people would say, you know, like, you're a Beatles knockoff, right? And he goes, no. He goes, first of all, he goes, we play I Am the Walrus. He goes, you know, they never even played it.
Well, a lot of those harmonies, they have a full horn section and a full string section. So it's not just the Beatles, the four Beatles, but like this whole accompaniment,
right?
You know, that goes along with it. Portland, Maine. I mean, it's almost like Ashland, right? We do Shakespeare. We got a Shakespeare festival. You know, we relive Shakespeare plays every year. And there they relive the Beatles.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. For all of our listening audience out there, if you get a chance, go to YouTube. I'm sure you can go to wherever you get your video content and see the new Paul McCartney video. And it's for a new song. And it's called Queenie Eye. Now, I don't know if you guys have seen it or not. Here's the premise of it. It's such a cool video. The song's really cool. It's very, you know, catchy, as most of his stuff is. But it starts off with him going to the control booth in the studio. We record in studios a lot, so we know what that's like. And he goes in there and he goes, yeah, do you want me to do a take to the engineer? And he goes, yeah, go down there and do one. So he goes down to the piano and he starts playing this song, Queenie Eye, right? And then they cut it in and Johnny Depp is sitting in front of the piano with his iPod on, singing along to the song as McCartney's playing it, like he's listening to it. And then they have Christopher Pine from Star Trek you know, Meryl Streep and, you know, all these really, really famous. And he has this gorgeous blonde chick that was in Star Trek with Christopher Pine.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. In the second one.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And she's laying across the piano, dressed provocatively. And what then it hit me halfway through the video was that if you've seen, you mentioned Sgt. Pepper's, the album cover was a mixture of famous people and common people, right? On the album cover, there was, you know, there was the Stones, there was, you know, there was, John Wayne, and then there was just the guy down the street. And well, in this video, he brings in all these famous people, and they're interspersed with, you know, all these just common people off the street. And it's so fascinating the way they do it.
Right now is a good time to be doing a good thing. And Heart, the Bare Naked Ladies, and country singer Willie Nelson all feel that they're doing the right thing in canceling their performance at SeaWorld in Florida, citing the recent documentary Blackfish, which raises questions about the effects of captivity on whales. The documentary is so powerful that it motivated fans to launch a change.org petition urging the bands not to perform at SeaWorld. Well,
yeah, I read a story. I didn't know about the Bare Naked Ladies, Willie Nelson, all that thing, but there was a thing I read the other day that Joan Jett had found out they were playing her anthem, I Love Rock and Roll, while the orcas performed at SeaWorld. And
yeah,
she,
the Shamu Rock Show, yeah.
Right, right. She sent a letter to them asking them to cease and desist from playing her song.
Yeah, so this documentary, I mean, it brought forth this issue, and it's harming the whales. It's, you know, because they operate on sonar. And this loud music just blasting into the water is hurting them. However, a SeaWorld spokesman said in a statement, you know, let's be fair, that the Marine Park officials respect the former's decision, but added that they were disappointed a small group of misinformed individuals were able to influence performers, meaning the filmmakers. So the science might not all be there. So this is kind of like in...
You know, I saw the movie Backlash, and I also recently went to SeaWorld. And, you know, it's just one of those... It's not a touchy subject, but it's one of those things where the world is... Everything is so politically correct. So if you want to make a name for yourself, just go out there, find yourself a cause.
Find a cause. Whales aren't the only one being used as trained performers. We use human beings as trained performers all the time. Like,
if you want to talk about, a creature being kept in captivity, it's kind of what it feels like with Matthew Perry.
Tell us about it, Johnny. Tell us about it.
First of all, for our listening audience
who want to know who Matthew Perry is, he was Chandler in Friends.
Chandler in Friends, and that's exactly what everyone remembers him at. That is the... You know, I would say the peak of his career. And just to give you an idea of what's happened since then, as far as his starring roles, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, an Alan Sorkin comedy drama based on a sketch comedy show like SNL, canceled after one season.
Yep.
Mr. Sunshine about a second-tier sports arena, canceled after one season. And Go On, which was kind of the weird parody of Community that they tried to replace Community with. Also canceled after one season. So this has been Matthew Perry's career up until now. And so the big announcement out of CBS, no longer NBC, is that Matthew Perry is back.
All right.
Yes, in a remake of The Odd Couple.
No way.
Hey, fourth time's the charm, right? Isn't that how it goes?
Dude, I thought it was three strikes and you're out, but apparently
not in Hollywood.
Exactly. And so this one, obviously based on Neil Simon's original play, The Odd Couple, is also a well-known movie and a television show, and there have been, you know, copious spin-offs, is now going to be the role of Messy Oscar will be played by Matthew Perry. They've yet to announce who Felix will be played by, but of course I was talking to Jerry about this last night. He was like, well, if they want this to be successful, they gotta bring Matt LeBlanc in.
And just Joey Chandler the odd couple.
You know what? That is really a great idea. I mean, I think Joey would be perfect, which he's Matt LeBlanc is the actor's name. But the casting is off, dude. I can tell you right now this thing is going to blow because Matthew Perry should be
Felix. Should be the clean freak, yeah.
Right, and then Matt LeBlanc could be the messy
guy. That's what I was thinking, too.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Well, I don't think I'm special when I smile, but when I play, I'm beautiful. I can't say I got that certain style. What I got, it's bountiful.
Joseph Strider's musical skill has found recognition at the Native American Music Awards. He talked about it with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. Today, we are really privileged to have on Joseph Strider. He is a musician out of Pennsylvania in the United States of America, and he's here to tell us about his upcoming new album. Welcome, Joseph.
Hey, man. How's it going, Edward?
It's going good, man. It's going good. I'm so glad that we have a chance to speak with you.
Same here. I'm really honored. Thank you very much.
Oh, appreciate it. The pleasure's all ours. And why don't we use this to start off by telling everybody a little bit about all of our listening audience out there about your music and where you know where it comes from and what you've been doing.
One of the things I'm always asked is like, okay, well, what exactly do you do? How do you describe your music? And then they say, well, are you a singer-songwriter? And then I said, well, who isn't a singer-songwriter?
Me.
Oh, you know, and I go, well, you know, James Taylor. And I said, yeah, he's a singer-songwriter, but, you know, so is Paul Stanley, you know? And, but of course, the music style is totally different. So what I did instead, I thought about this and thought about this, and then I came up with my own genre that I keep trying to push, which is modern indigenous alternative. Because as I am a part Native American, Apache to be more precise.
Okay.
I am, and then I get asked, well, then you're a Native American musician. I said, well, no. I'm actually a musician who happens to be Native American. I'm one of those urban Indians.
Okay.
You know, so I'm a city boy at heart, but that doesn't mean that I don't equally as love a mountain, you know. And actually, I prefer to be in a mountain, and I kind of live on a small one, so yeah, out in eastern Pennsylvania. I've been playing music since I was probably singing before I could speak. Boy choir, rock band. My first rock band, I was 14. I wanted to be a rock star at that time. I idolized Steven Tyler, of all people, from Aerosmith. I just, for some reason, they just really stuck with me. And then that's when I wanted to be a rock star. So I'm a little bit older now, and I don't particularly want to be a rock star anymore. I just want to be a musician. So after a while, I got rid of my electric stuff. I just own one electric guitar now, and the rest of my weapons are acoustic, you know, from banjo, mandolin, blah, 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 to my weapon of choice, which is a six-string. My two favorites are a Guild and a Taylor. They're my favorite guitars, and I've been working on my acoustic work for a long time, and way back when was it, 2008, I think, somebody said, you got all these songs here, why don't you put a CD out? And
right.
So I decided, I was like, all right, after enough pushing, I finally got it recorded, which was, it was, I forget how many songs on Meanings Within Meanings Within Meanings, 9 or 10. And I got them recorded in about 6 hours. So I had this CD that not a great audio quality. But then I got other people pushing me, let's do this, let's do that. And then I started, I lived in New Jersey at the time, and I was doing around Cranford. I got into New York, and I was doing, you know, just little open mic stuff thing. And then I was asked to submit it to the Native American Music Awards. So I did.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Native American Music Awards.
Uh-huh, okay.
The NAMBYs, as they're called.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's quite an honor to you. I see that you were nominated for your acoustic guitaring.
Right. I was nominated 2010 for Debut Artist of the Year. And I think at that time, yeah, I was with Spirit Wind Records, and I'm still loosely affiliated with them at the moment. With Mr. Donald Black Fox, who's the CEO for Spirit Wind Records. And I was nominated that year, and which kind of put a fire under me, so to speak. And I'd been working on a bunch of other pieces, and I decided, well, I'm going to go ahead and put out another one. And I think it was about that time I started to try to learn how to do alternative tuning. So I started doing that and using cable work, and then I came out with a CD called Little Bird, which had nothing to do with Native American anything. And the title is Little Bird, and the song is Little Bird. It's about 29 seconds long, just a little guitar piece. But on all of my CDs, I do acoustic pieces. And so I didn't really do anything with Little Bird. Next year I put out String Theory. And String Theory is 17 guitar pieces with a lot of alternative tuning, a lot of different capoing. And I have to say I was heavily influenced by, like, Michael Hedges, Tommy Manuel, Bruce Coburn, Andre Segovia, things like that. So I just concentrated on, and I worked probably about 2 years on acoustic pieces. I already begun doing that in the process of writing Little Bird. And so that CD, I was nominated. I got actually 3 nominations for that one at, again, at NAMA, Indian Summer Music, and then also this past year at Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Oh, okay, up in Canada then.
Right, right. So, and that felt really good to me because I was actually able to go on stage and perform for the audience at an awards show. So, you know, I was looking at it at baby steps. So I really appreciated that. And then in the meantime, as you know, us artists, we're always working on something.
Right.
So I had this smorgasbord of songs, guitar pieces. So I kind of knuckled down there, and then I went through, and I actually put out another CD that's just almost finished, almost, and with 11 new tunes. And I went back to the Native American things that I see. So most of that CD is Native American based, about whether it has to do with Native American stuff or animals or nature or something of that.
Well, when you were nominated at the NAMI Awards, the Native American Music Awards,
yes,
for Best New Artist, did you go to the ceremony there, where is it held?
The 2 times that I've been there, it's been held at right outside Niagara Falls at the Niagara Falls Seneca Casino Hotel.
Oh, wow. That's right. A beautiful area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is. You know, if you want to see the waterfalls, and, you know, yeah. And we spent some time at the waterfall, of course. And then, of course, the award show themselves. Yeah, yeah. That's where it is. And sometimes it happens somewhere in New Mexico, but I'm not certain where that is, and if they'll be, there's no telling up until the time when they'll tell you, you know, once nominations. And as a matter of fact, that's working on getting this up, because I have a number of places that I'm going to attempt to submit and see if they'll accept my submission for.
Now, are you going to get, you think you'll get a chance to play there?
Yeah, you know what? I doubt it, you know, but there's always that little spark of hope that it's a possibility. But, you know, because I don't know how much you guys know about Native American artists. I mean, there's not as many as there are, you know, mainstream contemporary, but there's a lot. And like mainstream contemporary, there's some that are not so good, and then there's some that are just outstanding.
Well, I could tell you right off the top of my head that the Joanne
Shenandoah, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She has a fantastic musician, beautiful voice.
Yeah.
And she's been on our show several times.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems to be played everywhere, you know?
Yeah, she has definitely made a name for herself. You know, I've only met her. I don't really know her personally, but of course I'm proud of her. You know, anybody who's able to stick to it, because, you know, this music game it's what it is, you know, and you really have got to have the cojones to hang into it if it means that much to you.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your new album, Carbon 14. When is it going to be coming out? And tell us about some of the cuts that are on there and what we can anticipate hearing.
The plan is, let's see how it works. The plan is that hopefully by next Friday, I'm going to have it finished.
Wow.
At the latest. And then it'll take me a few days. And hopefully by the third week, somewhere around the third week of December, it'll be available. And I'm going to put it up in a couple of places, Kunyaki, who I'll be sending it out to for dupe, and also CD Baby, and get it out there just in case somebody might be interested in buying a new Just Starter CD for somebody for Christmas. And
there you go.
Right, and then also to start getting set up for the award shows that will be happening and then pushing it.
Have you ever heard or met John Densmore?
Of who?
John Densmore.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Doors, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm an urban guy, you know. Yeah, so yeah, the Doors. Are you kidding? I loved them when I was a kid. Yeah.
Right. So were you? So did you get a chance to speak with John?
No, he was not there at those times that I was there. But I do not. I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question. I do know of him, but I didn't see him.
Well, I know that he's. I know he's attended.
No. I'm sorry. I couldn't say that I did. And unfortunately, I didn't get to see Richie Havens when he performed there. You know, and it's great knowing that and learning that these people have some Native heritage and they take some pride in it. And then the Native community opens up to their arms to that because, you know, who doesn't like to have a famous person in the family?
Yeah, that's such a good point.
And I don't look at that as a bad thing. It's a good thing. That means that somebody in the family is doing something and making a name for themselves, and they put a lot of time and effort and energy and all that other cliche stuff that goes into it. You know.
Well, Joseph Schrader, you are the famous member of your family.
Yeah. In a matter of speaking, yes. Yeah. So Carbon 14, and I'll just go right back around in a circle.
Sure.
Has, in this particular one, there'll be 11 pieces. And as I mentioned before, I like to do instrumental guitar pieces. And I've got three on this one. And you know, once upon a time, and still kind of sort of in my heart, I always thought, well, maybe I'll sit down and actually take classical guitar classes, which I just couldn't bring myself to do it. You know?
Not a problem. We know we enjoyed speaking to you and all your fans out there. You know, I want to tell everybody that Joseph Strider will be the featured musical artist on JustImagineInc.com, and it's Inc. Spelled I-N-K. And we'll put all the links up there to all your different sites where people can find you on Facebook, on Twitter, on josephstrider.com. Send your links to your CD Baby where you can go out and make a purchase. And we all are just like really looking forward to Carbon 14 coming out. Hey, I'm about to ask you a question, Joseph. You know, when after it comes out, will you come back on the show and tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. Are you kidding? Absolutely. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
All right. We want to thank you so much, Joseph, for being on. That's Joseph Strider, and his new CD is coming out in December, and it is called Carbon 14. Thank you, Joseph.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you very, very much.
To learn more about Joseph Strider, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Highly suspicious.
Deborah Boris's books give the voiceless a voice. She discussed this and more with the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we are very honored to have on suspense novelist Deborah Boris. How you doing, Deborah?
I'm doing really good. It's very nice here today. I hope it's that way there also.
Now, you're out there in Chicago, right?
I am, not too far from Chicago, maybe 2 hours away.
Oh, okay. Well, now you've written several books, and we're really pleased, you know, to have you back on again. Last time we talked to you, you had out Painted Black, and now you have out Bend Me, Shape Me. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. Bend Me, Shape Me is the second novel in what I'm calling my Street Stories with Scent series. In the series, I have a reporter named Joe Sullivan who seems to get caught up in the lives of the homeless kids that she meets that are living on the street, and no one else seems to listen to them. So in Bend Me, Shape Me, she meets Snow Ramirez, who is a bipolar youth who's living on the street with her brother, who is in a shelter that she believes is in danger from the psychiatrist that is treating him. However, because she's bipolar, everybody thinks she's either delusional or overreacting, and they're not paying any attention to her. It's not until Joe starts investigating that people start to realize maybe there is something a little bit more going on here than a radical street kid that is trying to get attention.
Well, you know, it's been getting some glowing reviews here, and really, you know, it intrigues me, you know, the way you write your novels from this street point of view.
Yes, that's important to me. I used to volunteer with youth on the street in both Seattle and Chicago, and it really struck me that the lives that they have are not being seen by people on an everyday basis. So I wanted to bring a reality to the fiction of my novels and make it as accurate as I could to give people a feel for what it's really like to be one of these kids and to have to deal with the things that they deal with on a regular basis. So maybe when you see somebody standing on the street corner, you're not as quick to pass judgment. You might actually become curious about that person and stop and talk and find out what their story really is rather than imagining all kinds of negative things instead.
You know, that's really kind of, you know, for me, kind of coincidental or surreal or whatever terminology you want to use, because I just recently this weekend saw the new Woody Allen movie, Blue Jasmine. And one of the main characters, she plays a woman that comes from, you know, she extreme wealth to nothing, and, you know, ends up on the streets, so to speak. And so, like, it's when you say that the next time you see somebody, because, you know, it really could be anybody. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, be poor, or, you know, it can happen to anybody. She, in the movie, she had a breakdown, so that's how, you know, she ended up there. But it's every walk of life. Am I correct?
Correct. It's like, especially with the economy having been so bad for all these years recently, people don't realize that it could easily be a family out there that's just like yours. It's just that perhaps sickness or mental health or economic circumstances beyond their control have created circumstances where they can't get up and out of it. They're trying, but once you get down there, it's really hard to get back up again.
Well, now, when you write these novels, where do you come up? I mean, I know where you come up with your ideas, and you kind of, I would imagine it's kind of loosely based on your experiences, but then your writer's imagination kicks in. And so how do you, you know, where do you go from there?
Well, I do the traditional thing, which writers always do, which is what if. So for the mystery plot, for instance, for this particular book, I read an article in, I think it was actually someone from the Pacific Northwest, that had been planning to sue their psychiatrist because they felt that he had harmed their autistic son. And when they investigated, it turned out that the psychiatrist actually was a mentally ill person himself and was trying to create his own personal army from some of his patients.
Wow.
And I started thinking, yeah, is this strange? So yeah. How could I not look into that? So I started thinking, okay, what if the patient that was being abused that way was not the son of a family that cared for him? What if that child belonged to somebody or belonged to nobody, but a kid who lived on the street? And so that's how I came up with Snow and Allie, her brother, that no one else is paying any attention to because nobody really cares. So they think everything is fine until snow starts to create waves.
Oh, very, very fascinating. Yeah, you know, what's the old saying about, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking when you were saying that about that psychiatrist. Where does it go from here? Are you working on a third book, or are you looking into adapting this for the screen? What kind of things are we looking at?
Oh, I would love to adapt it for the screen. If anybody out there listening wants to talk to me about a screenplay, I'd be happy to go into that. But the plans right now, I do plan on working on a third Street Stories novel. I don't have the plot sorted out yet. I do have a character in mind already, and I'm doing some research into that. In the meantime, while I'm figuring out what the main plot's going to be and coming up with that, I am working on a totally different kind of novel just for a change. I'm working on a cozy mystery that I plan to hopefully put out under a pseudonym, simply because it's so much different than my dark Street Story stuff. But right now, the Street Stories series will continue, and I'm hoping to have another book out in that in 2014. I just don't have any details yet right now because it's all still in the embryo stage.
Okay, and so what's the writing process like for you? Does it take you 6 months to write a book, 6 years? What's that? Walk us through that.
I don't know that I could say that I have one particularly, because the first book, Painted Black, I was working on that off and on for probably at least 10 years.
Wow.
Before it actually became published, where Bend Me, Shape Me was done in about a year. My plan, however, is to have a book done every year. Just recently, I've decided to go full-time with my writing. I've changed my living circumstances so that I'm able to concentrate on my writing as a career, and just maybe a little part-time job on the side if I needed a little extra money. So that should allow me to get out a book a year. The process is basically I don't do a lot of plotting ahead of time. I simply have a general idea of where I'm going to go, but I do a lot of in-depth characterization because my characters are the ones that drive the story. So it's almost to me more important to know my characters inside and out than it is to know my plot inside and out before I actually begin. I do have a plot, but I keep it flexible.
Well, I got to ask you this question. As an author, and I've always been curious about this because I'm not an author, to say you know your characters inside and out. Is there like a when you're writing this a novel, let's take, for example, you know, Bend Me, Shape Me, is there a point where you are Snow Ramirez, or are you a different character in the book, or are you completely detached from all your characters, or do you become one when you're writing about them?
I think all writers call from themselves in order to develop realistic characters. If you read something that the character seems real, then I believe the author has invested him or herself in it. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm bipolar or that I've done any of the things that Snow or Joe has done, but you really can simply take, everybody has been angry, everybody has been frustrated, everybody has had setbacks in life. So you look at something like that has happened to you, and then do the what if thing. What if, in addition to being angry, other people were doing this to you? And then you can extrapolate off of that. So you build on things that you know. Imagine what you would do or how you would feel in those particular circumstances. Now, that works for your hero or heroine kind of thing. Sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to do for the villain in your novel, because everybody likes to think they don't have any villainous stuff in them. But I think we all have a little bit of bad boy or bad girl inside of ourselves. And if we're honest, we could probably find some, you know, food to build on there as well.
Oh, I believe that we all do have a good and evil, you know, a light and a dark. You know, I would think as a writer would almost give you a poetic license to, like, well, you know what I would do? You know, because people often say to themselves, well, I would like to do this, but they don't do it, you know? But in a book, you could.
Exactly. Yeah, you know? It's kind of nice. You know, you could take your ex-husband or your ex-wife and you could make them a character in your life. I haven't done that. I'm not saying I did that. You can do that. That would be very therapeutic, don't you think?
Well, it might be for me, but I don't know how it would be for them. Yeah. A way to exercise your demons there, as it were.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I strongly encourage all of our listeners to go out there and pick up a copy of Bend Me, Shape Me, or Painted Black if you want to start the series off. They're available at Amazon.com and at Barnes & Noble and on iTunes and Kibo and just everywhere that fine books are sold. It's been so lovely having you on, Deborah.
Thank you very much. I've really had fun.
To learn more about Deborah Boris, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Have you heard the dark tonight? Somewhere on the hill.
Brown Dog. New York Times bestselling author Jim Harrison is one of America's most beloved writers, and of all his creations, Brown Dog, a bawdy, reckless, down-on-his-luck Michigan Indian, has earned cult status with readers in the more than two decades since his first appearance. For the first time, Brown Dog gathers all the Brown Dog novellas, including one never before published, into one volume. The ideal introduction, or reintroduction, to Harrison's irresistible everyman. Brown Dog underscores Harrison's place as one of America's most irrepressible writers and one of the finest practitioners of the novella form.
To most, a hospital is a bright, shrill, utterly lonesome place. Inhospitable, in fact. Visitors fail to make the slightest inroads on the notion that one wishes to be elsewhere. The night's full of slight but unaccountable noises, a factor of illness that penetrates even the vases of flowers, the professional smiles that you never quite forget are concealing skulls. Brown Dog, however, was enjoying his stay after the initial post-operative discomfort, natural to having a smashed kneecap put back in place and a few tendons reconnected. His only other time in the hospital, in Bozeman, Montana, had been far less pleasant for the simple reason of the subdural hematomas covering face and head. He was confident he could have handled two cowboys, but three were out of the question. Walking out of the bar for the fight, he had wrongly assumed there was a code of the West that guaranteed against gang rape. The good thing this time was that, unlike the head, you could distance yourself from your knee. It was simply there, the sharp edges of the pain dulled to a smooth roundness by drugs. Before being wheeled into surgery, he had made Teddy, who had accompanied him in the ambulance, promised to get the other half of a frozen road-killed deer up onto the raven-feeding platform at the cabin. Teddy was strong enough to pitch the carcass up there and wouldn't need to use a ladder. BD was mindful, despite his inchoate pain, that once you get the ravens coming in, you didn't want to disappoint them. He liked calling to them out the cabin window, and often one or two would respond, though when he tried to slip quietly outside to get closer, they'd fly away. On Barry's Sunday visits, however, there was the thrill of watching her gargle out her gaga-hrms, her chortles from deep in her throat, caws, chucks, clucks, and whistles. The ravens would wheel around the yard in a state of frantic interest, resettle on the platform, and peer down at the small brown girl who spoke their language. On the second day, when he was out of intensive care and ensconced in a ward with two very old terminal men and a motorcyclist who had hit an ice patch without his helmet, BD enjoyed a train of visitors.
Harrison takes pains not to paint his leading man as a noble savage, but the character's observations highlight the foibles and hypocrisy of modern life, says the Library Journal. Jim Harrison is the author of over 35 books of poetry, nonfiction, and fiction, including Legends of the Fall, The Road Home, The English Major, and The Farmer's Daughter. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, Sports Illustrated, Playboy, and The New York Times. He has earned a National Endowment for the Arts grant, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the Spirit of the West Award from the Mountains and Plains Booksellers Association. His work has been recognized worldwide and published in 22 languages. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
The Rouge never told me, never came up with a plan. All the stories that he told me didn't help me understand. But I had to get it worked out, had nobody who could help. So that in the end it turned out that I had to do it by myself. Life's a game, rags and riches, dogs and bitches, hunt for fame. Difficult to know.
Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Johnny Gomez.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now, stay there.
Play the blame on the snitches.